Nearly 20 years ago, Erin Brockovich became a household name thanks to Hollywood and an Oscar-winning performance by Julia Roberts. The movie, Erin Brockovich, is based on the true story of Brockovich, a legal researcher, activist, and single mother who discovered a cover-up involving industrial poisoning of a small town's water supply by Pacific Gas and Electric. Her investigation led to the largest toxic tort injury settlement in U.S. history. Over the last 25 years, Erin Brockovich has continued her activism. She is the president of Brockovich Research and Consulting. She consults on environmental projects all over the world, and she's traveling through Iowa this week, sharing her presentation, The Power of One. She spoke at Iowa State University last night, and she'll be at the University of Northern Iowa tonight at 7 p.m. at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. I talked with her last week from her home with her dog Scooby assisting on occasion. Hello, Erin.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for talking with me today. And so much of the work that you've done in the past 25 years, in the past 30 years, has focused on contaminants in drinking water. What do you think people should know about the water supply in the United States in 2020?
Oh, what I think you should know is that you're probably going to be really shocked at what you don't know and what we aren't always being told or what slid through the cracks or how the system is designed to work or not to work. And I think that would be the thing that would scare me the most that I have to say that really led to me writing my new book that's coming out in August. Its release date, I believe, is August 20th. And I'm so proud of the work, but the title is called Superman's Not Coming. And it's a look at our national water crisis, but what we the people can do about it. And I worry that we have thought for a very long time that somebody actually had our back on these issues. And there's going to be a whole host of reasons why that didn't happen. But what I don't want to do anymore is we got to have sit and blame anybody and everybody for everything that went wrong. That's not going to get us anywhere. But to realize that Superman's not coming, but to realize that we are here, to realize we have a moment through all this new technology to know more, to learn more, to do better, and to begin looking for that solution moving forward.
In looking at really a nationwide water crisis, from your perspective, there are, it's not really one big water crisis, right? It's many small water crises.
Oh my gosh. You know, that's an excellent question. When I began my work in Hinckley, California, and I have to say this because I just can't believe how long it's been. I was 30. I'm turning 60 in June. And not only has this problem not gotten better, it has gotten way far worse. But then again, it's always been there, but we've just not known about it, or we've just not understood it, or we've just found ways not to deal with it. When I started my work, when I was 30 years old, I felt like, you know, I stuck my finger in that dike to stop a flood. It was a microcosm of a representation of something that was happening across America. And it's very frightening even for me to see it today. But I'm glad that we're seeing it. And it's happening at, we need to understand people are still on well water and a system that's off the grid. What's going on and lurking out over there? 40-some million wells or 40-some million people on well water. That some 75,000 plus municipalities we have, and each one has their own individual problem. We have still illegal dumping going on. There hasn't been follow through with regulations. Some are getting rolled back. And every river and every creek and every tributary and every aquifer at some level has been impacted with a plethora of chemicals that we've just let run amok that I think we're seeing the end effect of what's been going on and the dumping and the pollution of our water system over the past 40 years and is now in our face. But I'd rather have something in my face, and I want you to know that, because see, now I can see it and now I can deal with it. And so instead of being overwhelmed by it or afraid of it, let's deal with it.
Now, of course, we recently had the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan, where the city's water supply had been switched to a different source and things were mishandled and residents found very high levels of lead in their water and officials did not respond quickly. I mean, this is something we could spend hours and hours talking about. And a lot of people have responded to that crisis by saying, uh-oh, is there lead in my water? But do you think that that's the question we should be asking when we see a crisis like that? I mean, what question should we be asking about our own water when that awareness gets raised?
Well, that's the first thing that, I think, Rod, and I had this conversation just before I got on here with you, is how and why people are or not responding a certain way to when they learn of a water crisis or the conversation began with all the climate issues that we're looking at. And that is, it takes people a moment. It's a shock. It's a shock for me, and this has been my career, to go, it hurts to learn that state representatives and our leaders, who you taught, were taught and believed had your back, were in fact the very ones that were doing this. It takes people a moment to process that and to come out of it. Now, they came out of it pretty well. It started with, I learned about Flint a year before anyone even knew what Flint was, from a couple of mothers. And they dealt with the, my gosh, nobody's listening to us. No one believes us. And I really understand that. Nobody believed me when I was out in Hinckley that the water was green and the frogs had two heads. But they came to us and we responded. And then once people started to know more, they would come out a little bit more and go, I can't believe this is happening. And what I'm seeing over here is what I can't believe is happening in Flint is, oh my gosh, happening in 220 other places in the United States of America. And it will begin with usually a mom in a community that wants to rise up. And oftentimes we don't learn about these things because the pushback is enough to silence them. And this was a group. Now, it took forever for us to push through. It's despicable that we still don't have a clean water situation there. And it turns into just a huge political show. I don't know if I can say that on air. I apologize if I can't. But that we're not really getting to the issue. And it's taken years to cut through. One is changing the lead and copper rule. That is something we need to look at. Many of our policies and rules are antiquated. They were written some 30 years ago, and they aren't applicable to today or how we move forward. But the lead and copper rule has now changed. But the lead and copper rule originally stated that you only have to test for lead in drinking water once every 4 years. And then you get to average the samples. So they could average of the samples may look like you never are in any kind of dangerous situation. So because of a policy and the way it was written, we're almost never going to find out. So because of this crisis and because of the pushing of the people of Flint, We did get in there with some prosecutions. We definitely saw politics get in the way of a lot of us moving forward. We learned something. We changed a rule. And we're going to have to continue to work out there, and not only there, but in all these other towns. And looking at, we have infrastructure that's failing. We have some 18,000 miles of lead pipe. And understanding that by adding ammonia to our water at the municipalities is creating a system that causes the water to be more corrosive, which is causing the lead and the iron and the manganese to precipitate out into the water in the distribution system, which is unregulated. We need to have a conversation about that. We have miles and miles of lines of distribution system of where the water comes in and where it goes out. What the hell's going on in there? And that is part of our crisis. And how these next communities, and they're everywhere, and you're seeing it happen in New Jersey. and how we change policies, how it forces us to look at infrastructure and the solution. That is my work and my pledge. Instead of sitting here today and looking at everything that went wrong, we see that it went wrong, accept that it went wrong, but how moving forward we're going to change the process. And that means we need to get busy at what are we going to do about our failing infrastructure in our water system and making that a priority. And what do we do rising up to change the policies that are as antiquated as our system moving forward so we don't continue to repeat the same cycle? Because we can't afford to. There is a true crisis at hand, and I think that we shouldn't be afraid to have these conversations calmly and without blame. Because, you know, and I've spent 30 years doing that, and it's getting us nowhere. But how we will have to address the issue moving forward. And Flint, as disturbing as it is, they rose up. It became a national issue. Hello, we now see you. But how we're going to not only get them finally in the end safe water, but begin to look at the other 200-plus sites that exist throughout America.
I'm talking with Erin Brockovich, legal researcher and environmental activist. She's traveling in Iowa this week. She spoke at Iowa State University last night, and she'll be at the University of Northern Iowa tonight at 7 p.m. at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. More of our conversation is coming up in just a moment. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with artist Greg Thatcher. He has been making art inspired by yew trees for the past 30 years. I'll talk with him about his exhibit at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Gardens. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is legal researcher and environmental activist Erin Brockovich. She's speaking at the University of Northern Iowa tonight at 7 p.m. And before the break, we were talking about lead contamination in water, and that's one kind of problem. But something that I know you've been working on a lot over the years, and many other environmental activists are working on as well, is looking at the contamination of drinking water in places where there are cancer clusters. Tell me a little bit about what you're seeing in different places with the crisis of that kind.
Well, I'm seeing it everywhere, and I do think part of why we're seeing it is there's some 40,000-plus chemicals that get into the marketplace, of which the EPA can only study a few because it costs millions and millions of dollars to do that study. And it takes years to conclude ultimately what that chemical and its association to public health and welfare is or isn't. And the best way for me to maybe explain that, because these hot spots are everywhere in the United States, and they don't always confirm that they're cancer clusters, but you will have communities that are like, I'm sorry, I think 40 ocular eye cancers in the area is too many. I mean, and that is just where they start. They just think it's too many. And I think latency periods could be running. So for many years, it's not like these pollutants popped up yesterday. This is the end result of decades of chemicals being dumped, going through the system. And each chemical that we could talk about has a different latency period. Hexavalent chromium can have a latency period of 25 years. So you could be just going along and unknowingly drinking it or being exposed to it. And all of a sudden, when that latency period runs, we see a cancer or a disease. And the best way for me to explain, I think a little bit of this would be the PFOA and the PFOS. And for people that aren't, you know, up to speed on that, and many of us aren't, PFOA is a perfluorococotonic acid, and the PFOS basically is firefighting foam. So I try to find a way to explain to people what it is. The PFOA you would think of as Teflon, and PFOS you could think of as a firefighting foam. These things are used as retardants on furniture. They're everywhere. This was something that 3M about 30 years ago did, where they took about 3,000 different chemicals, mixed them into one, and they call it the PFC, group of families, family group. And within it, you have PFOA, PFOS. So 3M does notify agencies that this is a dangerous chemical, so you should keep an eye on it. So the EPA, many years ago, set a guideline for this one chemical in water at about 400 parts per trillion, decades ago. All the municipalities are like, okay, so we can run this through our system up to 400 parts per trillion. Everyone goes on and does that. EPA commissions a study of this chemical, and it took about 15, 20 years for science to catch up with policy, if you will, that they come back to the EPA and they said, we have a problem. This chemical, which is the leading emerging contaminant in our national water supply today, causes cancer, several cancers, and diseases. So the EPA suddenly decides, we have to reduce that guideline from 400 parts per trillion to 70 parts per trillion. And then states like New Jersey are like, that's still too high. They're lowering it down to 7. And we have this crisis where all the municipalities are like, we don't have the budget to put on the appropriate filtration to keep just this one chemical out of our water supply. Then they have to notify the community. And then the communities notify me. Is this why my son has testicular cancer? Or my daughter has thyroid cancer? So people start putting the links together. So part of the issue that we have is the system has to change. You know, I look at this all day long. Of all these chemicals that we put into the marketplace, let's put them in there. Let's set a, you know, some kind of guideline. Let everyone drink it. Oh, to only find out it can cause cancer is really ass backwards. If you look at the FDA, who requires before you put a medical device onto the marketplace, you show me the study first, what this will or won't do. How about we, as an agency, say, you know, you're going to show me a study first on what this chemical can or can't do in the environment and to public health and welfare before I put it into the marketplace. So we're now having to deal with chemicals like the PFOA and lead and the failing infrastructure. And at the end result, these communities that are presenting themselves with cancer and diseases, not just in Hinckley, but throughout the U.S. So I'm dealing with this down in Florida and in North Carolina and in Atlanta and in many parts of Michigan, to answer your question. That's kind of how we got here and why I believe that we're seeing suddenly in our face, A, we're learning more, B, technology, Google, social media, we're connecting, we're starting to rise up, and we're now looking at the end result of what's been going on for decades.
At the same time, though, we're in a national political climate where a lot of the power of the Environmental Protection Agency has been curtailed and a lot of oversight has been backed off. How do you feel about the national political climate and actually getting the kind of response that communities need?
It's very concerning, and I am watching exactly what's going on. We're in deep trouble. I think rolling back some of our regulations could put us in an even more, you know, vulnerable situation with our water. And it will take, and I have seen, and I do talk about this a lot in my book, instead of waiting for Superman and that big oversight to come save us, we're going to have to bring this down to scale in our own backyard. And looking at permits and policies that happen right at city council. By way of example, in Hannibal, Missouri, the community came to us. They had lead levels in some situations as high as Flint. We went into town, and the group mobilized pretty quickly, and they went from 1 to, you know, 4 to 5 to 15 to 20 and so on. How and why they had lead in their water. So now in Flint, they switched river waters, which you can't do. And people need to understand water. And, you know, there's no two bodies of water the same anywhere on this planet. That's amazing to me. And you can't just come in and switch it because you create a very angry situation. And in Flint, their problem was they were adding ammonia to the system. We have to chlorinate water so we don't have all these outbreaks, you know, viruses, bacteria, E. coli. When you add ammonia to water that's already chlorinated, you're creating an even more, you know, angry water system. And the ammonia can render chlorination less effective, hence why we believe we're seeing so many Legionnaire outbreaks throughout the country. But in Flint, it causes corrosive water, which again causes, as I said earlier, iron and lead and manganese to precipitate out of lead pipes because the water is now corrosive. It's almost acidic. And this distribution system can get pitted and corroded, and all of that precipitates out into the water but is delivered to your tap. They got very involved at a very local level. And they educated the community about what ammonia was doing. And the group wanted to do more, and I'll tell you what happened. Some of them ran for city council, and they won. They made it their job to understand what was happening. They made it their job to inform their community. They ran for office, and they won. And they put a referendum out to the community. Do you want ammonia in your water, yes or no? Unanimously, they voted no. And it became law. And guess what? That changed. And now they're getting lead-free water. This is the power of us looking to ourselves right in our own backyard and not having the illusion some big agency is just automatically going to come fix this for us. Again, I look at and I share in my book about communities in Tonganoxie, Kansas, right in my own backyard, that really didn't want this Tyson facility there that they knew was going to create a pollution, and how they got with city council. And they didn't let that permit happen, and they got moved in another location where this municipality and this water system would not be impacted from, you know, runoff or anything else that would happen. And so my point is, yes, all these agencies are here for us, but at the end of the day, we as the people in that community, we have a responsibility, we have a duty, we have an obligation to ourselves, our family, and our community to show up at city council, right where permits start and construction will begin, to be involved. And we have this chance, and it's happening right now. And if we can do that everywhere, we can begin to affect change at a local level. And if each community at a local level did that across the board, we would be affecting change across the entire United States.
People get very caught up in national politics in some ways. People sort of follow national politics as if it's a sporting competition, and they post a lot online and things like that. What I hear you saying is that we need to pay attention to what's happening in our own communities. We need to follow local politics, state politics, because that's what's really affecting our lives.
Correct. And if each one of us did that, again, across the board, we might affect an overall a change. And you're right, we do. And I definitely, you know, pay attention to politics and I care about politics. But what I have learned over 30 years of doing this and in and out of communities is that we have disconnected from ourselves. How can I get you to reconnect? Because I think we are all starting to see the value and the importance of clean water, clean air, good land, food that's not polluted. And we're looking at the bigger picture of we all need this environment and planet to sustain and survive ourselves.
You have seen so many bad situations. I mean, you get called in to see the worst of the worst, and it just keeps on coming. What keeps you going? What makes you hopeful about the future?
The people, this conversation, coming to Iowa and seeing just one person light up and the change that they can make. That's what makes me hopeful. To see that while everybody's feeling disruption, and we are, but we're waking up, and I'd rather be awake than asleep. And I'd rather have people be awake and, you know, excited that, oh my gosh, if you will just get involved. It, I think the best way for me to say this is when I began my work in Hinckley, I quickly learned how I want to get out of this box because I knew who I was. But everybody else wanted to convince me I was this or that, and I'm not going there. And I think a lot of people need to not go there. And when I went to Hinckley, what was happening to them is what happened to me in school. Well, because you're not this or that, you can't do this or that. That's a bunch of BS. And I had someone say to me, you're not a scientist or a politician or a doctor. Why should we listen to you? And I'm like, really? Because I don't have to be any of that to be a human. And to tell you, as I stand here right now, looking at green water coming out of the tap and two-headed frogs, to tell you that's not right. And everybody in their own community. And this is where my hope and inspiration comes from. They're rising up. They're asking questions. They're getting involved. And they're not letting anyone throw them off their game. Hey, okay, I know that's going on out there. But I'm telling you right here in my town, where I live, what I know, what I see is not right. And they're responding. That's what continues to give me the hope that we are waking up. And we are finding our voices again and dealing with what we're dealing with right in our own backyard.
Your story has inspired so many people. And of course, it was nearly 20 years ago that the movie Erin Brockovich came out. And now there's going to be a new television show based on your life. I saw a show called Rebel. Tell me about this.
Well, it's in its pilot form, and we're getting ready to shoot the pilot, and I'm very excited. You know, I'm always not leery, but you never know how these things turn out, right? So I kind of just deal with what's happening in the moment that I see and know is happening. So it is about, and it's inspired by yours truly, I guess. I love the title Rebel, because I think a little bit of us are all a rebel that way. But it's about everything that we talked about. And, you know, social media and television and films and all of it can be a good platform for somebody else who isn't always that comfortable getting involved to go, wow, well, that could be happening to me. That did happen to me. I can be her. Oh, wait a minute. I am her, or I'm that person. And get them to be empowered by themselves again. So Rebel is going to run through a whole lot of different scenarios that have played themselves out that most people have no idea of things that are going on that's been happening ever since the film Erin Brockovich. So I'm excited that this could come to life and is going into its pilot as we speak as a way to, again, have a message that is inspirational to get everyone else to pick up that torch, you know, that happened out in Hinckley. I think that we've seen a stall, and I think that's because we become disconnected from ourselves, disconnected from this environment. There's been a false illusion, and as we wake up, we're going to grab that torch, we're going to run with it, and we're going to win the game. And so through Rebel's eyes, I hope that people can see that and get the message again.
Erin Brockovich, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, it was fun talking with you.
I've been talking with legal researcher and environmental activist Erin Brockovich. She'll be speaking at the University of Northern Iowa at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center tonight at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.